for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Journalist Gary Young compares identity to fire, saying it can create warmth or burn badly and destroy. In a new book, he argues that identity shapes our personal and political worlds, for whom we vote, what frightens us, and when we go to war. His book is titled Who We Are and Should It Matter in the 21st Century. Gary Young joins me in the studio. He is a columnist for The Guardian and The Nation. His books include Stranger in a Strange Land and No Place Like Home. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to you, Gary.
Good morning, Dave.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having
Tell
me,
whether you believe that 9/11 was a crucial turning point in the sense of our thinking about identity.
I certainly think it was in the West. In the West, there became this sense of us and the rest. And of course, those aren't neutral definitions. Who are we, you know, in that us? Does that include Muslims? Does that include immigrants? Does that and who are they? You know, who are the enemy? So there was this very sharpened sense, and terrorism will do this because when there's a terrorist attack, any other is a potential soldier. Anybody who you define as the other can then become a potential warrior. You don't know who the enemy is. So there was this sharp cleavage around the sense of the West versus the rest that I think became very, very dangerous.
So you feel as though somehow we've gotten locked into this place of East, West, and the rest.
Well, there was the class of civilizations rhetoric, that notion of Muslims somehow coming from some other psychic space that we, you know, that we couldn't really relate to. And of course, that pressure has eased somewhat as time has passed. But a very good example, I think, of the moral panic would be Oklahoma passing a referendum against Sharia law when less than 1% of Oklahoma are Muslim. There is no prospect of Sharia law becoming law in Oklahoma. And yet there was a sufficient amount of fear within Oklahoma that a referendum would be passed outlawing Sharia law, which is a little bit like me in you know, outlawing the Chinese taking over, you know, London. I mean, it's not going to happen anytime soon.
So would you argue then that perhaps it is fear, as you put it in regard to Oklahoma, that somehow shapes this new sense of we and them?
Fear is a big part of it, and for that we can look at terrorism, and then we can look at war as being very sharply defining things. There's no conversation you can have with terrorism or missiles. There's no way of kind of conversing with and finding the common ground. And there is this about identity, that on the one hand, we're all actually more alike than we are unlike. We're all human beings, and that can often be forgotten in these conversations. But the way that we are unlike matters, and at different moments it can matter in different ways. You just have to imagine that on September the 10th, you are a somewhat sexually promiscuous beer-drinking person whose name is Muhammad and whose parents happen to be Muslim. On September the 12th, you no longer happen to be Muslim. It becomes your defining characteristic, whether you want it to be or not, because other people have chosen that for you.
You know, you've talked about September 11th, but it also seems to me that the other has become exactly who we are in terms of political thinking in this country.
How do you mean?
Whether you are perhaps a member of the Tea Party, whether you're a conservative Republican, whether you're a liberal Democrat, it's really the other.
Right.
Now.
Oh, yes. That kind of there are identity works on so many levels. And so you find these moments where, and I've been in America since 2003, and quite often I've seen these moments, particularly during elections, where I thought, but actually, if we take you two people who are arguing right now, a liberal and a conservative, and we take you to France or Britain, actually you're going to end up, everybody's going to see you as American, and you'll end up realizing you agree on actually many more things than you don't. And the distinctions are sometimes drawn scarily sharply, I think, that and the way it comes out is in terms of whether you are worthy of being an American, whether something is American or not, that that peace is patriotic, or that war is patriotic, or that and it finds its kind of its crescendo in Obama, who they said, well, he can't be American, he couldn't possibly be, there's no way within the kind of that psychic realm that he can be American, so we're going to have to make up a story where this is not possible.
Not possible. So we ascribe to him that since his father was a Muslim, he, Obama, must be
a Muslim. Since his father was Kenyan, he therefore somehow must have been born in Kenya. That in order to accept that he is an American, for some, would be to force them to really have to grapple with what it means to be an American in the 21st century, when in 2042 white people will be in the minority, when large numbers of people don't actually fit into the boxes that are available to them in the census, when race is understood as something really very fluid as opposed to fixed. And for some people, the absence of the certainty of those old categories becomes very worrying.
As a black man yourself, do you believe you have a clear understanding of why people have taken that view of Obama?
I don't know if I have a clearer understanding, because I don't know that, you know, melanin content confers that kind of intelligence. But I think I have a particular understanding, which is partly from being black and partly from and being from abroad, and thinking, well, some of the things I've always thought with Obama, that race wasn't the half of it. When people talk about people, you know, being racially concerned, that it literally wasn't the half of it. That some of the things they say about him, they would never say about Jesse Jackson, because no one would ever question that Jesse Jackson was American. However, whatever else you think of what he says and does, no one would question the notion that he came from America. He actually couldn't be from anywhere else. But if you think of Obama, I'd say there are kind of two other things before you get to race. One is the suggestion that he is Muslim, even through birth, which of course is a nonsense, plays into the anxieties about terror and war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then if you think of his father being Kenyan, then you have this sense of foreignness, of immigration, of otherness. And interestingly, what Obama then does is almost like using the weight of his opponents to throw against him, is he then jumbles it up even further. So he then talks about his father coming to America in 1959 and says in the 2004 keynote, it's a magical place. Very few African Americans, I think, in 1959 thought of America as a magical place. But if you came from Kenya, I'm sure it was. And so what you have in Obama is an interruption of the established categories, the way that America thinks about race and nationality, and for some people it's almost like a synaptic shock. They can't get
a permanent change.
I think so. If we look at the demographics, if we look at the increasing number of people who are marrying and having children across racial lines, if we think of the growing number of Latinos and African Americans as a proportion of the country, that I think among the under fours, which is interesting to me because I have a 4-year-old, white children under four are already a minority in this country, that the future of this country is much more of a patchwork than it has been, then Obama's very varied and very complicated life story becomes actually the complicated story of the country.
Do you think that what's happening will be good for the country in terms of softening that whole approach toward identity?
I hope so. I mean, America has in the past proved itself capable of meeting those challenges, even when it doesn't fully solve the problem. So there's always hope.
Gary Young, he's a columnist for The Guardian. His new book is titled Who We Are and Should It Matter in the 21st Century.
More Zion Reem is just ahead here on WAMU 88.5. Good afternoon. It's a good one, too. I'm Elliot Francis. It's 2:18.
This is the WAMU 88.5 Community Minute.
Hi, I'm Donna Walker-James, Program Manager of Volunteer Alexandria. What Volunteer Alexandria does is connect volunteers to volunteer opportunities. Sometimes it's like being a matchmaker. We send volunteers to both nonprofits and city agencies, and sometimes it's for a parade or a weekend event. Sometimes it's for office work. One of the best examples of a volunteer that embodies what Volunteer Alexandria does is an architect who wanted to give back to the community, and he ended up doing plans for a local church where they had for a long time wanted plans done and just couldn't afford it. One volunteer in particular really touched me because she said that volunteering was really a life-changing event for her, and it makes you feel really good when you know that you're changing people's lives.
This has been the WAMU 88.5 Community Minute. For more information, visit WAMU.org and click on Community.
WAMU 88.5 is celebrating 50 years of providing the best in public radio programs. Help us go another 50. Become a member at 800-248-8850 or at WAMU.org. Thanks.
Winds are going to stay with us this afternoon, but diminishing to 30 miles per hour or less, with highs in the mid-80s. Tonight, expect mostly clear conditions with lows in the lower 60s. 80 degrees in Ocean City, Maryland. At 2:20.
This program of the Diane Reem Show was recorded earlier, so we're not able to take new phone calls. But we welcome your comments at drshow.org or join us on Facebook.
Welcome back. Garrett Young is a columnist for The Guardian and The Nation. His new book is titled Who We Are and Should It Matter in the 21st Century. Here's an email from Earl in Newfane, Vermont. He says, how does the us versus them idea stand up with respect to the Oklahoma City bombing, one of the worst acts of domestic terrorism in U.S. history? I do not recall a backlash against rightist fringe groups to speak of.
Well, I mean, there was a clampdown. I'm pretty sure that after that bombing, there was a clampdown, and that partly it wouldn't have been as visible. But I think, in general, the point Earl makes is a good one, which is that there are some groups for whom one talks in a collective sense, and others who one talks about whom one talks as an individual. So Timothy McVeigh is understood as an individual. We don't then, as a society, go after young white men with short hair. I mean, this played out very clearly in Norway, when, as soon as it was believed initially to be an Islamic terrorist attack, and then a whole range of suppositions and presumptions came out about Muslims and multiculturalism, then it turns out to be a white racist. And then we don't have that conversation about white people, because we don't really talk about white people in that way. So there is always that question with identity, that the more powerful our identity is, the less likely we are to even recognize it as an identity.
Then what you're saying is, as you referred to earlier, in 2040, when the proportions have changed and the majority has become the minority, would you see the conversations change?
I think the conversation will have to change. I think that the question, and I kind of end a couple of bits of the book by saying, we talk about identity all the time, and what the book tries to do is say, let's just talk about it more intelligently, is to kind of open up the complexities, let's open up the box, and let's have an honest conversation about it. So I think it's inevitable that we will talk about it differently.
How would a different conversation begin?
I can imagine two ways. One is quite scary and relates to the demographics, that what we're going to have, and you're already seeing in the southwest of the country, are older white communities and younger Latino communities who are looking to have the property taxes of the older white people, to build the education so that these younger people can create and work and so on. And so you have both an ethnic and an age differential, which could be very tense. The other conversation that we could have is one in which people actually kind of decide that this is something fantastic about America. It's something that they want to embrace, and that they choose not to be anxious, but to be hopeful. And there have been times when America has chosen to do that. And regardless of what one thinks of his politics, I do think that there was an element of that in the election of Obama. That's not an endorsement of him, but that there was some sense that maybe we can get over this. I think there is a desire among many white, black, brown, and others to get over many of the boundaries that have really hamstrung the country in the past.
Here's an email from John, who says, I've been taking philosophy classes that discuss identity. In philosophy, the debate is about what makes a person the same person over time. John Locke, for example, thinks that memories play a role in this. Recently, my grandmother began losing her memory of even important things, including the people in her life. How have you thought about how identity is affected by memory loss or even significant life change?
That's a very good question. Kind of erudite.
Isn't it there?
I mean, I'll give an example. It's a big question, but I'll give an example from my life. My parents came to Britain from Barbados. I was born in England. I have two brothers, one of whom lives in London now, and the other one lives in Ireland. I took my two nephews to the Statue of Liberty and the Museum of Immigration. And one of them said, this is a bit boring, really, because it's got nothing to do with me. And that in those two generations had been lost a sense of immigration. And they said, you know, your grandmother was an immigrant. And actually, I'm an immigrant here in America. And I said to my Irish nephew, you know, your father is an immigrant. He came from England to Ireland. And that what I had was a young 12-year-old Irish kid in his Irish football top, who's mixed race, and a young British kid with his... I don't know, Manchester United, probably football top, who was a mixed race, and their connection, their notion of a collective memory to this place where my mother is buried, where much of my family had kind of gone. And it didn't mean that they weren't, that they were antagonistic towards immigration.
Right.
But in a relatively short space of time, the notion of them being immigrants or of them having any connection to immigration had been... lost.
Or there being the other.
Of them being the other. And in many ways, of course, that's fantastic. In many ways, what you are seeing is people who are incredibly comfortable in their own skin, in their own surroundings. But it's through that sense that one day you might be the other because one day you were the other, that you might be able to connect with others who aren't you, with the gypsy or the Muslim or the Sikh, or if you're in Saudi Arabia, with the Christian who is who happens to be the other at that moment, as you once were in your family or as you once might be.
One of the examples you use in the book is Tiger Woods.
Mm. Well, Tiger Woods has this effort, this is before, of course, all the sexual scandal, to define himself, and he defines himself as a Cablinasian, a mixture, which in his family line he is, of Caucasian, Black, Indian, and Asian, and he has a name for it, Cablinasian. And he says, I'm not really Black, this is what I am. And I try and make the point in the book that it's very important that everybody has the right to call themselves whatever they want. That people, I often have this when as a Black Briton, even in England, where people come up to me, Mr. Young, where are you from? I'm from Stevenage, which is my hometown. Well, where were you born? Well, Hitchin, the town next door. Well, before then. Well, you know, there was no before then. Well, where are your parents from? Barbados. Oh, so you're from Barbados. And an attempt to try and... not just to tease out my story, but to say, well, you're not from here, so where, you know, so where are you from? So everybody must have the right to say who they are, but that what they say must make sense also, because these aren't just personal identities, they're also social identities. You're actually telling somebody your story, and so they have to be able to understand it. And that the problem with Tiger Woods' Cablinasian is that it's a nation of one. It's an identity of one. It's another word for Tiger Woods. And that doesn't mean that there aren't other people who may share that heritage, but Cablinasian as a group doesn't exist.
Does who or how Tiger Woods identifies himself, how does that change as a result of all of the sexual issues?
Well, interestingly, when the Guardian went to serialize my book, they said, you know, we need something in here about, you know, what's happened since, you know, this chapter was written. And I said, you know, I honestly think that was understood. That was his masculine identity coming through. I was intrigued in the commentary at the how little the fact of his racial identity really mattered. It was intriguing to many, although not rare, that pretty much all of the women that he had affairs with all looked like the same person. But that's, I think, quite common. But unlike OJ, unlike, you know, Jack Johnson back in the day, or other moments of which there have been Black-white affairs, this wasn't actually understood primarily through a racial lens. I think it was understood primarily through a kind of celebrity lens, and that he did what a certain kind of man does at a certain point in his life. And it was interesting, actually, I think, for the absence of racial conversation.
Do you think that your own background, as people have tried to pin you down over the years. Has that identification that you make for yourself, how has that affected your outlook on identity?
Well, it's forced me at different moments to reckon with some kind of lazy thinking. That when I was young, I grew up thinking I wasn't British, because most British people would tell you you weren't from there. You know, they would say, well, go back to where you came from, or whatever. There was that notion of national identity not being a kind of also a racial identity. And then I went to Sudan to work in a refugee school, and people would say, where are you from? And I would say Barbados, which I'd been to for kind of 6 weeks as a four-year-old, and it really didn't make any sense. And so I had to deal with.
That's up.
Yes, I had to kind of deal with my Englishness. And then at different moments, actually realizing, you know, actually there are lots of things I like about England. You know, I like the sense of humor. I like, you know, I like a good cup of tea. I like a range of things that, in the same way that one would say about Jesse Jackson, well, he couldn't be from anywhere else, that I think after about 15 minutes of meeting me, people think, well, obviously you're an English guy, you know, or a British guy, and that that is who I am, and that I had the choice of either fighting it or learning to love it.
Gary Young, his new book is titled Who We Are and Should It Matter in the 21st Century. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Should it matter? Will it matter? Does it matter?
Going backwards first, it does matter. People die for their country. People are prepared to die for their tribe, for their group, for their religion. So, and they're also prepared to live for it. So, so I think it does matter. I think the question is how it matters. And when I talked about identity being like a fire, that you know, it can warm or it can burn, that there are all sorts of ways in which people may identify that are actually very, which extend the notion of our humanity. They don't restrict it. They say, well, you know, if I see a 4-year-old child in Somalia and I have a 4-year-old child, my connection as a father, my connection as a human being,
exactly,
is enhanced, and those are means of identifying. You know, the Irish, when they were protesting against the Brits, who sang "We Shall Overcome," and took their cues from the civil rights movement. Regardless of what we think of them, the people in Wisconsin who carried the protesters who carried placard saying "Walk like an Egyptian." There are all of these ways in which we identify and connect with others, or can, and that's the great thing about identity. The terrible thing is when we retreat into our identities as though they are our lagers. Identity, I think, and this is the argument in the book, is your ticket to ride, but it can't be your destination.
What do you think is happening in England right now? In London, in other areas?
Well, that was a very interesting moment a couple of weeks ago with the riots, which on the one hand seemed to come out of nowhere, and on the other hand had been kind of predicted over the last few years with the economic crisis. Now, the main thing that was interesting about these riots is that they were very mixed. They were very multiracial. These weren't ethnic riots like in the 80s. They weren't race riots, although the single thing that sparked them was the shooting of a black man in North London. But what continued after that wasn't. So there was that was interesting. And if one is looking for an identity in those, it was mostly about youth. It was mostly young people, who many of whom have actually only known recession and crisis. and for whom the prospects are not that great. And that's true for them regardless of their race, although more so depending on whether you're black or not. The other thing was just, though, how completely depoliticized they were. There were no demands. There were no slogans chanted. And in the absence of that political framework, it became about sneakers and high-resolution televisions and fighting the police.
Of course, England has had a great many refugees, people from other countries coming in to its cities, to its country. Do you believe that England is even farther along in breaking down racial barriers and ethnic barriers and social barriers than we here in this country?
It's a mixed bag. I mean, in some ways it is. The levels of mixed marriages, for example, are much, much higher in Britain than they are here. I think one in two Caribbean men, one in three Caribbean women is in a mixed race relationship. Britain is peculiar insofar as we had our civil rights movement, but it was abroad. It was in India and Ghana and Jamaica. So we never had codified segregation, or rarely had codified segregation on British soil. And on the one hand, that means that we don't have the geographical baggage. On the other hand, people think, where are all these people coming from? And we're coming from their past.
Gary Young, and the book is Who We Are and Should It Matter in the 21st Century.
Coming up Monday on the Kojo Namdi show, Hurricane Irene, assessing its impact and whether emergency preparations made the grade, plus the human hunger for knowledge and what it means in the age of information overload. The Kojo Namdi show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU
88.5. Welcome back. If you've just joined us, Gary Young is a guest here in the studio this morning. He's a columnist for The Guardian as well as for The Nation. His new book is titled Who We Are and Should It Matter in the 21st Century. I'm going to open the phones now first to Nelson in Silver Spring, Maryland. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I just had a quick comment. I'm an African-American. I was raised in Harlem, and the dominant politician at the time when I was a kid was, of course, Adam Clayton Powell. And the point I'd like to make is that, underscoring what the author has said, is that Adam Clayton Powell could be seen as a politician who, in many people could see, who was purely egocentric. Egocentric. Everything emanated from Adam. Jesse Jackson, on the other hand, came to be seen, unfortunately, as ethnocentric, although he wanted to cross over so he could get white votes if he ran for public office. What's unique about Obama and what he signals connected to globalization is that he's a world-centric African-American politician. And I think it's a big change that I've seen in the in America and the African-American community. I think it underscores, as I said, what you said. The other quick point I'd like to make is that I'm also West Indian, at least in terms of my family. And within the black community, we've had the same sense of identity as it relates to different groups, or different islands, in fact, where people have come from. That's simply it. Thank you.
Thank you.
I mean, it's a very good point about Obama being world-centric. And actually, I think that's what scares some people, actually, that he somehow they can't pin him down in a way that they would like, and that these forces of globalization and the movement both of jobs overseas, of people into the country and so on, make some people scared. And I think for some people he doesn't personify a beautiful new future, as some people see it, of kind of mixed race cosmopolitanism, but a present of frightening global forces that are coming and taking our jobs and, you know, populating various areas of our cities. That for some people he signifies that rather than something something really great. I'm not making a judgment on that right now, but I'm just describing the way that he might be understood or misunderstood by some people.
What about religion? What about Ireland and how it has dealt with or not dealt with religious differences?
Well, Ireland is a very good example, actually. Ireland is a good example of a number of things. The primary one, I would say, is just change. How the one thing that we can be certain about with any identity is that it will change. And that's what makes people anxious quite often. And what it means to be Irish, both north and south, has changed hugely in the past 20 or 30 years. And particularly the case I make in the book is about a competition that's actually only just finished called the Rose of Tralee, which is a beauty competition to find the perfect Irish rose. And this year, actually just last week, for the second time running, it was a mixed race woman. This time it was a Filipino and Irish. The last one was a Indian and Irish woman, which very much speaks to Ireland's present. It used to be the place that people left to go around the world and to find jobs. Now, or over the last, I mean, with the crisis, things have changed. But for the last 20 years, for the most part, it's been a place that people have come to from the rest of the world, from Poland, from Ghana, from Nigeria, and so on. And so what it means to be Irish has been transformed, and that has carried on to the north, where they no longer look at themselves as being this kind of, this puppy in the basement, this kind of, you know, orphaned part of Britain and Ireland. But increasingly, if you go to the north of Ireland, you see cranes everywhere, which is about building, which is about some sense that kind of there is a future. And if you look at the two people running Northern Ireland at the moment, it's Sinn Féin, which is the political wing of the former IRA, and the Democratic Unionist Party, which was their deadliest foes. I mean, almost literally deadliest foes. And it shows the degree to which people can, if the right climate is created, move on. What they're doing in Ireland is moving on from Catholic and Protestant to being primarily, to being Irish. Northern Ireland was the one place that's one of a few places, Palestine being another one, or Israel-Palestine, that Sesame Street decided that they couldn't transfer their model to because it was just too riven. I don't think that's going to be true in about 2 or 3 years' time.
You don't?
No, I don't.
So, in other words, you're fairly optimistic.
I feel like I have to be optimistic. Sometimes, despite all evidence, there's the thing about identity, and this is how I finished the book. It's saying it's like the boy who cried wolf. The thing about the boy who cried wolf that people forget is that there was a wolf at the end of the day. With identity, there is always a wolf. There is always someone trying to divide us on the basis of things that make us different. But I'm a black British guy living in America who's lived in Russia, who's lived in France, who's lived in Sudan. And wherever I've been, I found people that I can converse with and who I can talk to and who I can love and enjoy. And that suggests to me that however great those differences are, they're not greater than being a human being.
The economics do play a role. And economics somehow create even greater divides than perhaps might otherwise exist. The forecast for this country, at least, is that economics are not going to be so great for a while. so that I would assume that these feelings of difference of the other are going to continue. It used to be said that whenever the economy went down, racism began to play a larger role, or even prior to that, that Jewish people were blamed for everything. So I wonder if thinking about the economy, how you think it will play a role.
That has been certainly true in Europe, for example, where the far right, the hard right, has increased almost everywhere in the face of the economic crisis, and that is a big worry. But there's always the potential. I don't want to sound too Pollyanna-ish here, but there's always the potential that these crises actually throw different people into the same situation, that they understand that however different we may be in ways that one might describe as superficial, we can make those differences superficial, but neither of us have enough to eat, and both of us need to get our kids educated. There is a good line from Jesse Jackson, I can't remember which campaign it was in, where he said, when the lights go out in the factory, we're all the same colour in the dark. And there is that possibility also, which at different moments has... those possibilities have come through.
But unfortunately, the anger against illegal immigrants in this country, who many people believe are taking jobs, that anger is rather prominent.
Yes. And that's, I mean, it's a very good example that of the globalization, the issues of globalization that I was talking about before, where people live in fear of their jobs being transported to Mexico or being outsourced to China, of their local store being replaced by a bigger, you know, chain store. And so people feel that they're losing control. And you can't get hold of the person who's moving your job to China. You can't get hold of the person who's who's transforming your neighborhood in ways that make it uncharacteristic to you. But just down the road, here are some people standing at a corner who look different and who in some ways personify this this world that you're anxious about. So these small minorities become emblematic of a broader fear that people can't quite deal with.
Let's go to Detroit, Michigan. Good morning, DJ.
Good morning, Diana. I just wanted to ask your caller a question real quick. I wanted to ask you, have you experienced any of the hardcore conditions for minorities in America? Like, have you been to Detroit? Have you been to Compton, California? Like, what is some of the worst experiences that you've seen for us in this country?
I have. My first book, No Place Like Home, I followed the route of the Freedom Riders through the Deep South and spent a lot of time talking to people about their experiences then and their experiences now. And I have actually spent a fair amount of time in Detroit, which from the first time I went there, to me, and this is not a slide on Detroit, but there was a sense of almost the post-apocalyptic. It felt to me like what happens when capitalism doesn't need people anymore. And so huge buildings, beautiful buildings, just left and abandoned, some with trees growing out of them. And one particular story I did that was very troubling was about a young boy, Brandon, who had been shot in the back while running away from a security guard, and he hadn't really been doing anything. What was worrying about this was that his name never made the papers. He was a 12, 13-year-old boy. And his father had since moved from Detroit. And he said, you know, when I think of that this city couldn't even be bothered to say my child's name after he'd been shot, I thought, I don't want to live in this city anymore. And I thought that was heartbreaking.
Did that father leave?
He left Detroit.
Go ahead, DJ.
I'm just kind of saying that, like, what he said is exactly right. Like, when capitalism leaves, it leaves the people just to suffer. And right now, we are, like, I don't even know a scale to put it on, but I feel like, I don't know how to feel about it. I'm 24. I'm African-American. I'm trying to go to school, and it's just, I don't know what to do anymore. And as a writer, I hope that you take this back to your home country and let people know, especially minorities there, that, like, it's a need for the African diaspora, like, around the world to unite. Like, even not just minorities, but all people that's disprivileged needs to come together.
An interesting addendum to the story about Brandon, which speaks to identity, was that the person who pursued that story vigorously, the one person who pursued that story vigorously, was an older white woman who worked for a local black newspaper who just wouldn't let it drop. And that was also a very kind of touching element, because I hear what the caller is saying.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
I always want to say to people, this is not just an African-American problem or a Muslim problem or a white problem or a religious problem. It's a problem for all of us. I mean, so we have to share this planet, and we either are going to, you know, we're in this boat together, and it can sink or it can sail depending on how we work together.
DJ, your comments were so heartfelt. Thank you for calling, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's a caller in Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Rachel. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you. I just have a question. I have three children whom are multicultural and aging in range from 14 all the way down to 3. And race has never really been an issue in our home. We recently moved to Texas a few years back, and I don't know if it's just the kids getting older or moving to the South that's changed, but everybody wants to classify them and ask what are they? Are they Indian? Are they Spanish? Are they black? And actually, they're a mixture of all three, because my husband's from the West Indies in Trinidad. And my daughter, of course, who has different type of hair and, you know, whatnot, she's just asking a lot of questions. And I find her just desperately trying to, you know, bond to one culture or another, whether it's one group of friends or whatnot. And I just wanted to ask, I thought I had it all figured out. Like I said, when they were little, it was just you're brown or you're not brown. And I just wanted to see if you had any advice as the dynamics are changing in race, you know, throughout the United States.
Yeah, it's a very good question. And I think the only advice I can give is that you have to encourage them in their pursuit of working out how they fit in, not where they fit in, but how. And that if you, for example, if you read Dreams of My Father, Dreams from My Father by Obama, you see this long journey of a mixed race kid in Hawaii, then in Jakarta, trying to work out what he is. But the other thing I think to emphasize to your children is, you know, in all sorts of ways, regardless of our racial heritage, we're all trying to work out who we are. That this is not a burden specific to you, but that this is a great journey that you're on to find out kind of what works for you. And pity those people who don't make that journey.
I hope that helps, Rachel. All right, thanks for calling. Last quick question from Carrie in Richardson, Texas. She says, in Great Britain, there are legal Sharia courts. It's also suspected there are more unofficial Sharia courts there. Why is this unimaginable in the U.S.?
Well, in Britain, the way that it works is that all and any religion has the right to their own civil procedures. But those never override British civil or criminal law. So we've long had religious courts for Jews and for other religions. And really, Muslims are only doing that. The question one must ask ourselves is, why would we deny to Muslims what we give to others?
Gary Young. His new book is titled, Who Are We? Thank you so much
for
being with us. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Sarah Ashworth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jacks. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. A.C. Valdez answers the phones.
Hi there, I'm Rebecca Shear, host of WAMU 88.5's Metro Connection, and welcome to Door to Door, our weekly trip around the region. Today we swing by Logan Circle in Northwest D.C. and NoMa in Northwest and Northeast D.C.
My name is Jim Malone, and I live in Logan Circle. The residential areas of the neighborhood are incredibly fascinating. You can walk around and look at the variations of Victorian architecture, and the circle itself is kind of a fascinating space to spend some time in, and, you know, it's sort of the quintessential Washington, D.C. public space, I guess. Most of the day you have people walking their dogs and, you know, all the commuters. It's very different from DuPont Circle. This is more of a residential circle, but it's still quite lively. The thing about Logan Circle is the core of the area is pretty well established right now, but the fringes are going to start developing a little bit more. You have the O Street Market to the east. A fair amount of change will be taking place up and down 14th Street. And then to the south, you have the enormous city center project and the Convention Center Hotel that will be going up, which will definitely change things along the edges of the neighborhood.
My name is Liz Price. I'm the president of the NoMa Business Improvement District. NoMa stands for North of Massachusetts Avenue. This was a name city planners gave the area about 10 years ago to spark the interest of investors and developers. Before then, it was mostly industrial or vacant land. This was a low-lying part of the city, and it would flood its banks on a regular basis, so it didn't have the best reputation, let's say. The most noteworthy event in this neighborhood was the Beatles' first North American concert in 1964 at the U-Line Arena, which is still here. Things really started to change in 1999 as developers and other property owners started to look at this part of the city because it was so proximate to downtown and to Capitol Hill. It had a great location, and it was close to Union Station, but it was just far enough away that people felt like you needed another metro.